today on Vox Talks Economics. Can the finance sector change the environmental behaviour of firms, and how? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember to subscribe and follow us on Instagram. Well, this summer, Vox Talks has been bringing you interviews from CEPR's Paris Symposium, and this should have been the last of those conversations. But today, I'm looking at two microphones with no one behind them, thanks to a reason you probably already guessed. COVID-19 meant that two of the people I particularly wanted to interview aren't here. Well, I'll catch up with both of them later because their papers help to tell an important story about the role of economists, investors, and protesters in the fight against climate change. So, until then, I guess it's time to pack up my equipment. This important story begins in 2014 when offices and universities in the Netherlands began to see demonstrations from civil servants, students, and even their teachers. Those demonstrators would chant, "We are unstoppable, another world is possible." Well, why are they chanting that? Because they wanted to change the investment decisions that a pension fund called ABP was making. But what would that other world be, and why did they care so much about ABP? When I eventually caught up with Dirk Schoenmaker of Erasmus University, he explained to me.
ABP is one of the largest investment funds in the world, 450 billion euros in assets, and it is doing the civil servants and the education sector in the Netherlands. And our students were protesting at ABP because they were investing in fossil fuels.
So, ABP, Europe's largest pension fund, and the pension fund used by academics, among others, asked three of those academics, that's Dirk and two of his colleagues, to advise it on its best strategy in the light of these protests to help create a green transition.
And then the university body said, well, let's use our own smartest mind. We got a team of professors to advise ABP on the fossil fuel investments. That's how I got involved. The goal was really to give advice to ABP, what would be the best practice. And we had full freedom in our advice. Of course, we got information from ABP. And what we set as goal was, how can we speed up the energy transition? Because it is not about divestment, but it is about speeding up the energy transition. That's the concern of students, fellow academics who were protesting at the doors of ABP. So that's what we set as our goal, speeding up the energy transition.
The report that Dirk and his colleagues submitted might not have been what those protesters expected, and it certainly wasn't what they wanted. It didn't recommend divestment at all. In fact, for a limited set of fossil fuel companies, it recommended that the fund should, I'm quoting from the report here, engage deeply with these companies and monitor annually predefined reductions in emissions. Why did Dirk recommend this?
You would think that just going out because they are the big polluting oil giants, that's the best strategy. But for the future, for the energy transition, for example, if we go to a hydrogen, the green hydrogen, that we need massive investments. But we also need capacity to build these infrastructures. And that's exactly what the big oil companies have.
This, Dirk explained to me, is stewardship theory. To invest in firms that damage the environment today, but who are committed to change, rather than walk away from them. And this is done on the assumption that this engagement will help accelerate the green transition for the entire economy.
So what we said was, okay, from the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we know we have to reduce carbon emissions by 7 or 8% per year. So that's what we set as a target for oil companies. And those who can achieve that, we keep in the portfolio. those who are not moving, we divest. So we call it smart engagement. So you make targets. So the target is 7-8% reduction per year. And that's what we discuss in engagement, but smart that you set a target. Then you monitor. So with the willing, you move on. So what we expect from our advice, that let's say from the 10 big ones and the 90 small holdings in oil companies, that maybe 5 or 8 are left who are speeding up the transition. That's what we hope.
On Vox Talks Economics in the past, we have been more accustomed to discussing carbon taxes and carbon pricing as a way to influence corporate behaviour. Economists, for many years, have been advocating a carbon tax high enough to redirect strategy and innovation for those firms. But Dirk believes that a carbon tax alone isn't going to get us to where we need to be.
So what we need is all instruments possible, and I call it complementary. So not one or the other. And then we are ending up as economists recommending a carbon tax. The carbon tax is not happening. And then we sit back and that's it. I happen to be in finance. So I look what finance can do. And finance can help out with strong, smart engagement. If you're in government, you have to invest in the new infrastructure, the hydrogen, and you need to do the carbon tax. So every party should do its own thing. I think it's very important for academics to look a little bit beyond only the cost of capital, and engagement strategies can be quite powerful. And we really need more research, which strategies work better. I encourage fellow academics to put this topic of engagement, working together, investors and industry, to make things happen, rather than thinking in the old-fashioned principal agency that you work against each other. You take your responsibility as investor to help a company out to move to the new world. And that's an interesting new way of thinking and a fruitful way for research. I think working in tandem and help the frontrunners to move can be a successful strategy.
So, how widely do economists and experts share Dirk's belief that the financial sector can be stewards of change? Well, to do that, the financial sector, at the very least, needs to correctly price climate risk. Now, the other attendee at the symposium I wanted to catch up with was Jeffrey Wergler of the Stern School at NYU, because he's written a paper that collected the opinions of hundreds of these experts on questions exactly like this.
My co-author and I should mention Johannes Strobel, an NYU colleague, sent an email survey to about 11,000 finance professors, as well as regulatory, relevant regulators and policymakers. And I think the hardest part of that was just gathering the email addresses, which fortunately we outsourced. And ultimately, we received about 900 total responses. We felt that that was a pretty good response rate to an email survey request on an emerging topic received out of the blue by two professors, and many of the respondents, you know, hadn't even heard of us. It's interesting to know what 900 relatively informed, relatively interested people working in this space have to say about these issues. Respondents overwhelmingly, by a factor of 20 to 1, believe that climate risks are underappreciated by asset markets as opposed to overappreciated, overpriced. So we asked this question about stock markets, about insurance markets, about real estate markets, and pretty much every group of respondents with respect to every one of those markets thought that climate risks were widely underappreciated.
So is the problem maybe that investors don't know how to price climate risk yet, in which case they could still be effective stewards at one time in the future? Or is it that not enough of them care enough about climate change to influence the strategy of the firms in which they invest?
There's certainly massive uncertainty with climate risk. We don't know how or where or in what industries or when it's really going to play out. We know it's coming in some sense. We know it's already here in some respects, but it's still possible, as it has been for a long time, to entertain a sort of wide variety of opinions and defend them with almost equal plausibility. So it's hard to point at the current pricing and say, well, markets have it wrong now, and they should be reacting more strongly. Another thing to keep in mind here, I think, is that asset markets price profits and losses. They don't price externalities. They don't price general miseries or health consequences of a warming climate. And so we're looking at a somewhat narrow perspective. And you and I, in our daily lives, we may look out the window and say, oh, climate crisis is here. But until that's reflected in corporate profits, one way or another, we're not going to see asset markets respond. And I don't think we should expect that to happen. Let's posit that our respondents really have it right, and asset markets currently are ignoring the risks to some extent. And I think it's an interesting question about which we can right now only speculate. How is the market going to sort its way to proper pricing, to a repricing of climate risk, so to speak? One thing that could happen is that there's a sort of drip drip of climate news over the coming years and a slow, correspondingly slow repricing of climate risks. You know, when asset markets are pricing profits and losses, those are not going to change overnight. And so there's going to be some slow losers, some slow bleeding, and there's going to be some slow winners too. And so you might expect in a sort of efficient market, to use the jargon, that there would be a correspondingly slow repricing of risks in the absence of some sudden shock, like sudden massive regulation. And that, frankly, doesn't seem to be on the horizon. So there could be a sort of drip-drip response. Another thing that could happen is that there could be a more or less spontaneous repricing of climate risks by investors. And there is precedent for this sort of thing. We saw in the internet era that suddenly investors seemed to look around and said, you know, these assets are too high. This category of assets, this internet thing, this technology is overvalued. And there was a sudden repricing of that exposure over the course of just a few months to a year. And there was really no particular event that you could point to and say, this was a reason to reprice those risks. This is a reason to realize, you know, this changed from yesterday, that markets should reprice that exposure.
How likely is it that we will see this sudden shift in sentiments in the near future? Well, not very, according to the respondents to Jefferies' survey.
We asked, what are the biggest short-term risks? And by that, we quantified as, for the respondents, as over the next 5 years. And what are the biggest long-term risks over the next 30 years? And people thought that the biggest short-term risks involve regulation. And I presume what people have in mind there is some widespread effective regulation of emissions, maybe a huge curtailing of fossil fuels. Now, does this surprise me? If the alternative is physical risks, is that more important than regulatory risks over the next 5 years? The physical risks to life and limb and corporate assets, then I would say no, the regulatory risks are more salient, more here and now, at least in relative terms. And so maybe that finding is not surprising. And I guess personally, I don't want to believe that the physical risks are around the corner. So there may be an element of denial among the respondents at play here. But when we look at history, we see emissions steadily increasing at an increasing rate, and regulation just not keeping pace. So there's a lot of talk, but just not the political will. And the U.S. can't even join a treaty banning cluster bombs. It's hard to imagine the political will for some massive regulatory imposition on emissions.
Now, of course, since the survey was completed, the risk of strong government regulation, well, perhaps has receded, thanks to a war on the borders of Europe and also the Supreme Court's decision to limit the power of the Environmental Protection Agency in the US. But at the time the question was asked, there was little support for the idea that investor pressure would be the biggest influence on the environmental policies of firms in the near future.
Taxation and regulation were viewed as the biggest potential forces for change. The respondents are economists, tilted toward financial economists, to be sure, but the powers of regulation and taxation are well understood. So what has to happen for investors to care is that profits and losses are affected, and in the absence of big policy changes, that's not going to happen anytime soon. There could be a spontaneous repricing of risk, but, you know, we shouldn't bet on that. Customers as a force for change, that's also an unreliable mechanism. Customers want goods that use wood, that use concrete, that use steel, industrial chemicals. There's no way for some meaningful fraction of humanity to get the goods to sustain their current lifestyles without, it just can't happen that corporations were going to somehow green themselves overnight and consumers could get the goods that they want. So I think respondents had those facts in mind.
But perhaps could the management of those firms, the boards, also become stewards, voluntarily leading the transition, perhaps to head off future investor pressure and protests like we have seen in the Netherlands? Again, this idea was not widely supported in Jeffrey's survey.
I think it was hard for respondents to imagine corporate behavior, you know, that relies as a result of economic competition on acquiring your supplies at the lowest cost possible, whatever the upstream emissions might have been. That just seems like an unlikely, unreliable mechanism as well as a force for change.
Is this bad news for the argument that Dirk's paper makes?
Dirk's argument does receive some support as a potential force for change in this last section of our survey about the potential forces for change. Institutional investors, and I think Americans would have in mind people like BlackRock's Larry Fink, and a small number of other very influential institutional investors in mind. Now, what they actually do in terms of U.S. headquartered institutional investors, that hasn't really been an overwhelming response. We see a lot of just index funds taking up the assets that are sold by more activist institutional investors. And there's lots and lots of big companies. We have index funds, Vanguard, DFA, and so on. Just, you know, that's their mandate, is to hold the whole market. That's a very appealing investment message for many, many investors. So we would need a more concerted effort to make a huge difference. But there's no question that a small number of dedicated, very large-scale institutional investors could make a real dent in this issue.
One objection to the idea of stewardship is that the success of engagement is hard to monitor. Is it really possible for pension fund managers, for example, to decide if their investment strategy, their engagement, is paying dividends? Well, Dirk thinks that's possible.
We don't need the numbers behind the decimal. It needs about that you have a significant change. So one easy future indicator I always tell my students are capital expenditures, CapEx. So what is your investment plan for next year? And you can monitor whether they executed it. So if you still send 90% of your investments to fossil fuels and do a token 10% in renewables, then you are not moving. So this type of thing you can observe. The big oil companies have to publish their emissions, sometimes difficult to find in the annual report, but they have to publish them. So also that you can monitor. So it takes a bit of work, and there are organizations who are monitoring. So it is possible if you want to.
Initially, ABP seemed to be following this path of engagement as recommended in Dirk's paper, despite consistent protests. In May 2021, it even published a press release saying that constructive talks, as it called them, with Shell about reducing carbon emissions had yielded results. So what happened next?
In the Netherlands, Dutch pension fund giant ABP says it'll divest more than $17 billion in assets from fossil fuel companies ahead of the COP26 UN climate summit, which opens next week in Glasgow. ABP said as recently as June it would keep its fossil fuel investments, but reverse course amid widespread protests and legal challenges.
Yes, in October 2021, ABP abandoned those plans to engage, instead selling its 600 million euro stake in Shell, as well as its stock in all other oil and gas majors. In the end, the people who were paying into the pension fund, they didn't believe that those constructive talks could be a strong or a swift enough influence. Of course, this raises the question that can investors who choose to divest rather than engage also create change? Jeffrey Wergler thinks that's a possibility, but perhaps not the smooth transition that Dirk's paper envisaged.
It's disappointing in a way, because financial markets really can exert pressure on corporate behavior, but the messages from prices need to be strong and consistent, and it appears that we're just not there yet. Frankly, a gigantic asset market crash that is driven by a sudden realization of climate risks might well be the best thing for the world in the long run. So I have mixed feelings about that happening, but for my kids, my grandkids' sake, I wouldn't vote against that.
This is a choice that many institutional investors are going to be making in the next few years. So if you want to read up about it, then the two papers that we featured today, Jeffrey Wergler's survey conducted with Johannes Strobelow, is called What Do You Think About Climate Finance? And the research that Dirk, Helen de Koninck and Roel Betsma did for ABP is now published as Fossil Fuel Related Investments and Climate Change. And you can find both of those available for download. This has been a Vox Talk, not in the end recorded live at CPR Paris Symposium 2022, but hey, we got there. Every week we bring you the most important latest research, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you subscribe, you'll find more than 200 episodes now, so whatever type of economics you prefer, there's a Vox Talk waiting for you.